Hello.
Hello.
We're going to be continuing Carlo Scarpa, talking about two of the famous projects, as Luke was just saying in the first attempt.
Yeah, so we're going to talk first about the Querini Stampalia Foundation and then about the Castelvecchio. These are two of Scarpa's most famous projects. They're both museums. They're both in this incredibly sort of highly wrought, rich, luxuriantly detailed and idiosyncratic Venetian interpretation of modern architecture that he has. They're both about intervening into existing historical buildings in a way that I think lots of people have found very exciting. It's if I was going to try and sum up his like approach to historical buildings, it's in a certain sense like very perceptive, like very observant, but not in the way that people often describe it, sympathetic. Like I feel like there's quite a lot of tough love going on.
It's not subservient.
Yeah.
He puts himself as an equal to the historic thing, rather than the approach of either being fearful or just attempting to frame.
Yeah.
Which people are like the fearful weak approach is where you just kind of like leave it or build a glass box around it or have a like glass tunnel coming off, and this is
Or put it underground.
Put it underground. Yes. Oh, that's a great one. Yeah, just we will preserve it in a tomb. Or people will try and bring the old thing out. Rarely will people go, I'm going to take this and like I'm going to recarve the stone.
Yeah.
Which is definitely what he's doing. And in both of these cases, I think it makes a lot of sense. Partly because the stones tend to be recarved anyway, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if this needs to be said now, but as a general, this is a general philosophy of mine rather than that time continues and artifacts have existed through all of it. Buildings don't remain the same. And an approach to history is to, you have to kind of, with something important, you have to kind of, if you want to do that, choose when you want to make it.
Yeah.
And there's often a weird process of peeling back time.
Yeah.
And what you're left with is a skeleton. It can be amazing. If you think of like the skeletons of the great baths in Rome or something.
Yeah.
That approach can kind of, which have had like all the accretion scrubbed off them, all the barnacles removed. It does leave you with something where you're like, oh, this was built by giants.
Yes.
It's not human.
Yeah.
I don't think it gives you a truth of history though. But any case, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a very different approach.
Yeah.
Which is to recut the stone and reset it, really.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So I think we should let's get straight into the first of the projects that we want to talk about, which is the...
This is like the most Venetian modern building ever, I would say.
So, I mean, to give like a little bit of backstory about what this is, it's the Querini Stampalia Foundation or Museum is It was a palazzo. It was one of these like noble palaces, not quite like the creme de la creme because it's not on the Grand Canal, but in a kind of a bit to the north of San Marco, and it's got its own river entrance. And it was since the family the last Querini Stampalia had no issue in sometime in the 19th century, and the whole thing became
1860s. They were they had been a minor noble family called the Querini.
Yeah.
And then they managed to finagle inherited governorship of one of the Dodecanese islands, which they called Stampalia.
Yeah, lovely.
And they built a like black castle on top of it and tyrannized the locals of this tiny island and became the Querini Stampalia.
Yes.
And that was the basis.
Yes.
Which is very, I say that just because it's so Venetian, you have this very, it's the serene republic, the serene setting based on empire.
Yeah. It is a kind of like pestilence on the rest of the Mediterranean, actually, like yes. There are long parts of its history.
Particularly sort of small bits. I mean, the Dodecanese are not great big islands, and I don't think this is a big one. That's the sort of structure.
Yeah. I'd forgotten until recently that they were sort of ultimately responsible for blowing up the Parthenon, among other things. among their various infamies.
Yes, I would say them.
It's a collaboration.
But it was a collaboration between them and the Ottoman army, yes. Yeah. Yes, it had a roof until like the late 17th century.
But from the 1860s, it's one of these like. It's like a historic house museum with the family collection and also with a big library. And it had been run as a foundation since then. And I think essentially what happened is that in like around the late 40s, early 50s, there is a guy called Giuseppe Mazariol, who became the director and was like a slightly more energetic kind of guy, and also a friend of Scarpa. And so that's sort of how there ends up being this commission to do some work, particularly to the ground floor of the Palazzo, to reconsider how it's entered and how it's visited, and to create spaces for doing like events and having a more kind of contemporary program as well as the, as well as this sort of existing stuff.
It's understandable, really, which is that you've got it's a small museum with a small collection of some things that are worth looking at.
Yeah.
But with an institution, a director will always be wanting to do more than sitting around as the custodian of these things. And there is more building than they needed. So.
Yeah. And I think the deal with it was that when it was... turned into a museum, they set up an entrance which kind of came in the back. So the way it's located within Venice is that there is a front looking out onto this canal, which obviously historically is the way that you get in, and then there's a garden courtyard in the back, and the entrance, the public entrance for all the Baedeker wielding tourists coming to see it was to come into the back courtyard and then go up the stairs and go and see the house rooms. And the front part of the palazzo wasn't very used and wasn't very usable either, because it was subject to
really obvious point. Yeah. The fronts of Venetian houses front onto canals with no path in front of them.
Yes.
So because the main entrance is from a boat.
Yeah.
So there are reasons why through the 19th century, Venice was becoming a more walky city.
Yeah,
like, and they were making more.
They filled in some of the canals at that time, and they even made some attempts at like modern streets and things like this.
Built a bridge.
Yeah, built some bridges here and there. Yeah. Oh, and also a big bridge connecting to the mainland.
It really losing its character as a really completely water bound.
Yeah. And then, so I think that the Scarpa's kind of big idea for this refurbishment is obviously point one is to kind of restore the way that this building sort of faces out onto the canal, to kind of restore its identity as something facing the water rather than kind of turned in on itself. And there are some pragmatic things which need to be sorted out, because I think that the floor level was relatively low in those areas, and they needed to deal with the fact that the water had at that time already been starting to get a bit high and to come in. And
which I think is an eternal, that the ground floors of Venetian buildings have always been sinking and flooding and being in need of continually refacing and replastering and scrubbing and fortifying and underpinning.
Yeah.
And because it's a city built on...
Yeah, I mean, it's...
extremely unprepossessing mud banks.
Yeah, yeah. It's not really a place the way a city should be in the first place. So it requires a bit of commitment to the bit to keep it
going. It makes it kind of... So in this magical reality, he has to fortify against the water this floor.
and also create a new access, which is a new bridge coming into the front. So we're just looking at the sort of overall plan, where at the top you can see the courtyard garden, and then at the bottom of the plan, the three sort of roughly square rooms looking out onto the canal. And in the midsection, there is the stair, which goes up, and a couple of new gallery spaces, which he creates.
The biggest room being one of the galleries by some margin.
Yeah. Yeah, so I guess we could just talk about the ground floor spaces.
Yeah.
Because they are, I mean, the nature of Scarpa's architecture is that they are lots and lots of these little, incredibly precise, sort of jewel-like elements.
Yes, I mean, my feeling is very often he designs moments.
Yeah.
Like, or elements, particular spots, more than, with some people, it's really about creating a whole.
Yeah.
Having a kind of total vision.
Yes.
And there is a total vision because it's all very much his style. But I think elements, little places is where Carlo really comes into his own. And I think it's also the fundamental element of his design method.
Yeah. So there is this new bridge, which I think we're going to talk a bit more about later, but which kind of brings you into an entrance space. And the strategy for dealing with the water is slightly different in the different rooms. So in the entrance space, there's like a raised threshold. So you effectively come in a little bit higher and then come down these steps.
Yeah, I think it's worth, if we get a picture up of that for the people following along. Oh, you're meaning this zone here?
Yeah, that one.
Yeah, so basically the you come over the bridge and there's a raised plinth.
Yeah.
I mean, with all of these images, I just see so many of his tropes.
Yeah, we've got the classic, little squares within big squares paving.
Yes, which I feel is, that's a very kind of northern Italian thing. This like lots of layers of lots of stones put against each other.
Yeah.
I mean, it feels a bit like the stones on there's that small building in St Mark's Square, which has got lots of little squares of like slightly different coloured stone. I mean, they're bigger squares, but
materially, all of these spaces, there's a lot of rich materials which are kind of slightly glossy or kind of dully but sort of richly reflective. A lot of the ceilings and many of the walls as well are made of this polished plaster Marmorino stuff, which is a kind of marble based plaster with a wax on it.
It's a lime, slick lime plaster. I think they put linseed or wax or but anyway, it's high gloss.
And
often he colours them dark, which is kind of bold.
So it becomes all about the reflection whatever it is, diffused light.
Yeah.
There are these three little square rooms looking out onto the canal, and then the strategy in the first one is kind of raised plinth as you come in. The strategy in the second one is the water comes into the room, and there's a sort of raised concrete causeway that you walk over, with a little sort of expressed lip on either side of it, so it's a little bit like a kind of Moses causeway. And I don't know whether, I mean, to be honest, I think they probably close the building if the water ever actually does come in there, but the kind of romantic idea is that at high tide it would sort of come all the way up but not quite in. You'd see it
To some degree. It's the first logical step of this, which is very often the case with his work, is very logical, which is that these buildings have water entrances, which are recessed into the buildings, which flood.
Yeah.
That is a completely standard feature and was pre-existing.
Yeah.
He's then enclosed it a bit more and put these fancy, beautiful metal grill gates on it.
Yeah.
But then has extended the idea whereby it's not just that he's made this complicated stair with a lip which you step over to step into the building. He's also kind of wrapped the water around the walls.
Yeah.
You know, in various... Yeah. I mean, only theoretically. So only if the tide is high.
Yeah, it can actually like snake in and come in on both sides of the...
Yes, little and then that fill maybe, up. And then into the next room as well, I think.
Yeah, 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 yeah. So I think the idea with the third room is that the water actually can just come into that room. And
yeah.
That everything has, there are these plaster panels on the wall, but they have a kind of raised bottom. So you could, in theory, have like an exhibition going on and then the water would sort of come in and then it would go away again and then you could get on with the,
and there's a sort of
the canopy reception.
There's also kind of these jokes, well, not jokes, but like things being peeled back, right? So the water comes in, which is the kind of ground condition.
Yeah.
He's got these fine polished plasters. He's got hard stone, like Ruskin's, like thin slabs of stone over roughness that make up Venice, and
like
then
white,
he's
like white stone.
Yeah, like like travertine, isn't it?
I think it like might be Istrian. If it's the classic Venetian one.
Yeah, it looks almost more grey than that. I don't know. Yeah. And then really deliberately rough concrete.
Yeah,
it's not your nice grey. It's got loads of exposed aggregates, which is like river pebbles.
Yeah.
And it feels very much like compacted riverbed. A game he likes to play is putting earth in buildings. There's a house that we almost certainly won't talk about because it's too obscure. But the ceilings look like they're made of soil.
Yeah.
It's brown, like clay, and completely rough.
Yeah.
In all the rooms. And this seems like it's revealing a ground.
Yeah.
So it's kind of revealing the primeval stuff. And then at the same time, that concrete is being peeled back a layer further to reveal kind of details of the old building.
Yeah.
Some of which are not mega significant, but there's a little kind of semi-capital thing around the top of an arch.
Yeah.
And this hunking, tough concrete is just nudged back.
Yeah, just to...
Just a touch, just to sort of emphasize the point.
Yeah, at some point he talks about, I can't remember which of the buildings he's talking about, but he has this thing, and I don't want to touch that thing. I don't want to touch the historic building. I think it was when he was talking about the Canova one that we talked last time, the reason why it's separated. He says, I don't want to touch that building. And the way he talks about it, it's sort of slightly like, it combines like, I don't want to touch that because then I'll have to make an annoying sort of like threshold waterproofing detail.
Yeah.
Cut something in or whatever. But it's also like a kind of almost like a hygiene or something. Like
there's a
real hang up, but it's a very productive kind of hang up that he has.
Yeah, I understand it. It's there's two things. One of which is if something is its own thing, if you come up to it, you're interfering with that.
Yeah.
Now, whatever you do, you're going to interfere with that. But how can you make it more itself?
Yes.
Well, if you don't touch the building, let it be itself, but then kind of camp, like, or not, like, you know, exaggeratedly don't touch it.
Yeah.
You know, you're like the mime artist making the box, right? You're creating a frame.
Yeah.
Even if it's not a real one. I mean, here he's literally framing devices, which is something that will come up again and again.
Yeah.
But that's it. So I think these rooms are, you think, okay, we're going to make a really practical, useful additions to the ground floor. And we're going to have three rooms which have no functional purpose at all, except one is a way in.
One's a way they're in, all,
but like you can't use them for exhibition space or like really... But what they're kind of like an exhibition of Venice, right? It's like of this watery city that's old and made of mud and precious stone and
absolutely
in this most Venetian everything is this is the most Venetian building
we sort of slightly glossed over it, but there are also in the Rivergate bit there are these steps up which are these sort of ludicrously like overwrought but rather amazing little sort of play of chamfered squares all touching up against one another.
This is almost ridiculous. They look like slices of fancy cake.
Yeah.
Thick icing of white stone on top of rough concrete coming up in this kind of... Do you think they're allowed to have people walk up and down that stairs.
Oh.
It's like slippery, wet marble with no handrail in weird shapes.
I suspect that that is like a prerogative of...
The Signori?
I think architectural restorers.
Yeah.
I think the...
That's what kind of... Yeah, the
my impression,
elect.
My impression of Italy is that the various professions like to reserve special things for themselves that only they're allowed to do.
Yeah.
So I imagine there is a qualification.
I think the antinet also probably, like, tangential, familial, and fraternal connections probably gets you there.
Yeah, and then the... I mean, I don't really know how to describe the, like, gallery space, which is the other big ground floor space, but it's, for me, like, very, very... sci-fi vibe about it. It's lined, I think this is travertine, isn't it, that it's lined in this like highly
That's
sort of speckly, it's full of holes. It's it's the stone that lots of Rome is made of, isn't it? Like I think of seeing it everywhere in Rome. It's
although here it's rather like, you know, in Rome they were always striving to get the stones that were the most even.
Mm-hmm.
Here he's gone for a classic modern thing of trying to get... Now we're in a post-concrete world.
Yeah.
We're trying to get the stone which is most rough.
Yeah. The walls, the kind of direction of the stone is so chosen so that they're all kind of going in different directions all over the walls. Everything is offset. There's this kind of almost like dado rail made of like brass that cuts the whole wall into. I think there is hidden behind all of this a super elaborate air conditioning system or like ventilation system to try and suck all of the moisture out of the spaces.
I think there's a notional idea throughout that put a certain amount of these, like off, everything is offset.
Yeah.
Which is just something he loves doing.
Yeah.
But the idea is that you can put behind that not only an air conditioning system, but also just places for everything to dry out.
Yeah.
This principle, I mean, normally you do it when you're like building wooden sheds and things, that the air should be able to move around everything to dry it out when it gets wet.
Yeah.
And I think that's a principle that's being employed here.
Yeah. And it also has the, this thing which is like one of his weirdest obsessions, which are like moving walls, or in this case a door,
flat stone doors,
stone door. Yeah,
these are in at least three projects.
Yes.
They're really cool. It's a kind of expensive way of doing a door, and also this door is just a shutter. It doesn't, like,
yeah,
you could still kind of get through even when it's closed.
Yes.
The super articulation of stone in this project is another thing which is like indulgent and fanciful and beautiful and sculptural and not like goes beyond what I would say is just architecture, really, into it's something you could almost, you know, in the Beaux-Arts tradition, it almost feels so decorative it would be something you'd almost hand over to the to the people doing it. But panels of stone where the edge has been elaborated to go up and down and, you know, taking it kind of for a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And then joints articulated by doing cutouts around them. There's that, like, radiator ventilation panel in the middle of the first three rooms, which I think is made of sections of stone stuck together with gilding between them, looks like it's kind of assembled out of, like... The language, at one sense, seems to have evolved out of something super, like, primitive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you lay these big stones together and just have a notch to kind of dovetail them in. Or not that elaborate. But then turning that into, repeatedly an image of itself, where it's become... like these super cutout things where, and then gilding joints and stuff is just decoration as well.
Yeah, so there is a way of kind of describing the story of where these things come from, which does find real historic kind of antecedents. There is, a church in Torcello which has moving stone shutters
and this kind of thing. The cathedral.
Like it does exist, but really, these things belong to the domain of science fiction, don't they? I mean, this looks much more like something from the Incal or Hodorowsky's Dune or something like that than it does.
They are groovy.
They are.
There's a streak of like 60s grooviness.
Yeah.
But rendered kind of, this is very Italian, isn't it? Like something that feels like you're not sure if it's really cheesy or just like really perfectly tasteful.
Yeah.
I mean, I probably lean more on the perfectly tasteful here, but it's got a cheesy edge.
It's also, there's also a little bit of, certainly with a piece like this Radiator one, which is this play of different kind of square and rectangular cutouts moving over these planar surfaces. Graphically, this feels like something which could be sort of De Stael or something from kind of 20s graphics and interior design. But what's very unlike that is the fact that it has a very explicit materiality and material texture.
Yes, although I feel that he's really influenced by, I mean, he's obviously influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright, and people talk about that a lot. Yeah. But also, I think those Central European run up to the First World War and afterwards guys, you know, Wiener Werkstätter, Behrens, like, you know, Raumplan.
Yeah.
Even like Hoffman.
Yeah.
All that sort of stuff where they are really into the materiality, where they do love it made of stone or gold.
Yeah.
Or hammered brass. And there's lots of, like, this thing, interest in, like, having lots of, like, cross frames. And
yeah.
There's lots of things that I think come out of that lineage as well. I actually think that none of his elements... He is someone who exists in an architectural tradition. He's not attempting to invent things whole cloth. He always just takes an element and then radically transforms it.
Yeah.
Everything is radically transformed. Nothing is straight lifted. But also, everything exists in a lineage.
Yeah. But I think also, it's, as we'll see when we look at some of the drawings, there's also just like an endless grinding of the wheels of like drawing and iteration.
And he just loves to perversely alter things.
Yeah.
Something is straight, let's make it not straight.
Yeah.
Let's have it go along, down, and then up again. He cannot bear to have anything just be... Everything has to be elaborated.
Yeah.
Nothing can be straight joined.
Yeah.
Everything has to be elaborated. And that's a point where it's beautiful, but intrusive. Like, he's intrusive, I feel. Like...
What do you think it's like asking to?
I mean, it's like so this like stuff of, you know, like the primal material of Venice and then like covering it. That can kind of exist at a level where you're not having to think about it too much. If you don't think about it, it can kind of wash into you and be like nice.
Mm-hmm.
You can't not think about these like extreme elaborations. You look at them and you're like, this is a guy designing lots, and I can really intrusively feel.
Oh yeah.
How much he's designing it.
You're deep inside his.
And that can be like, in the right mood I can be appreciative, in the right mood I can find it irritating because it's like so.
Yes. He has a great affinity for the Radiator. It's one of the few in general that he sort of suppresses surfaces. Although he loves like articulating nearly everything at the level of like elements, furniture, joints, connections. But services he generally tries to hide and cover up, with the exception of radiators, which he rather loves, I guess, because they lend themselves to this sort of elaboration, these wiggly pipes and things.
Yeah. I mean, these are even more elaborate than Wagner's.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, extremely elaborate ones. I mean, obviously, these are, like, eternal, like, pharaonic, inscrutable ancient
onyx radiators
instead of really sci-fi. They're more like ancient aliens than future aliens, aren't they?
Yeah. Do you think these are these belong to the 1850s or something. They,
oh, yeah. Yeah. But if it's in your sci-fi world, it's Howard Carter discovers alien tomb under pyramids rather than that.
yeah.
Trying to take your... I think you're more natural in that language.
Yeah. Anyway, so. No, but I think, well, I think we're going to, we could develop it a bit further. But I do think, certainly the story he always liked to tell was like, this is this kind of eternal, sort of tectonic identity.
Eternal tectonic of
Venice.
Of groovy radiators.
Well, yeah, this is like the natural sort of state of Venice, articulated through the contemporary moment and kind of contemporary technology. Sure. But I think, I think that's,
whenever
I don't.
Whenever people say that,
yeah,
what they're doing is they're making a claim to define something eternal.
Yeah.
And I think you've got to reasonably grade it against, well, how successfully is he like retconning? How successfully is he just making us in that moment believe it?
Well, for me, not like partially, but I also believe quite strongly in it as like, this is the interior of the space station in like Space Venice.
There isn't a real thing which is like eternal soul of Venice. That's like a human idea.
Yeah.
And he's trying to kind of flesh out that idea. It's like a brief, not like a, cities have souls in our hearts, but they don't have it in like physics.
Yes.
And the things in our hearts are kind of mutable.
Yeah.
And he's playing with that idea.
Yeah.
It's also...
I mean, there are definitely...
These are space-age projects.
Yeah.
That is his era.
It is. Yeah, no, he is channeling that. I guess to push back on that a tiny bit, I mean, there is... Like, there's genuinely a kind of quite specific sort of material culture in Venice.
Yeah.
Like, which is the material culture of, like, buildings built where buildings ought not really to be built, and out of a certain amount of plunder, which does lend itself to lots and lots of bits which have sort of been put together, but there are, like, about, like, six different jigsaws mixed together.
And also, like, implausibly rich.
Yeah.
But it's not just a material culture. It's an actual condition.
Yeah.
And it's one that it lends itself really well to this sort of treatment, right?
Yeah.
In some way, that's a more normal... Like, if you were going to sum up the soul of a more normal city, you would end up with something far more banal, because most places are, in their heart of hearts, much more banal.
Yeah.
You couldn't say that most cities are, like, at their core, something extraordinary, because they're just what we live in. Like, even if they were all space stations, it'd be all like, oh, we're all so bored of these space stations. They're so humdrum.
Yeah.
It's like, this seems like one of the most willful things. Mostly he confines himself or is confined to the ground floor, but there's the actual...
Yeah, so
the collections are upstairs for obvious aquatic reasons.
Just for audio description purposes, so this is the staircase, which is the sort of existing staircase going up to the upper stories.
And it was rather worn down and flaked.
Yeah.
And he's done a succession of things. One is the walls. I don't quite understand how they can be this concrete. They surely weren't made of this concrete.
I don't know. They just rendered.
Yeah, so are they like rendered in the concrete underneath? It seems really perverse. So like the first thing to be done is that there's this like pebble-dash concrete.
Yeah.
And then above that set out is a beautiful render.
Yeah.
Except that as it goes up the stairs, he's arbitrarily cut it into steps, like big steps. But they're of fairly arbitrary size and width.
Yeah.
So it sort of steps up along, up a little bit, along a little bit, up a lot, along a lot, up a little bit, along a little bit. And there's a gap with this like pebble dash concrete underneath. And then the treads themselves, you can see the stair underneath, which is all beaten up old stone. And then he's layered new stone treads on it with little stone risers supporting them, but which have gaps in them so that you can see the old stone.
Yeah.
And
yeah, there's a kind of...
You're left with this much... The main thing you're left with is actually the new staircase, but with kind of like this weird thing of it being scraped back in an extremely mannered way at the edges.
Yes.
With a little telltale slot in the middle.
Yes. Sort of crotch.
Yeah. Which is a very not subservient approach to history.
Yeah.
The history is there.
But it's like, yeah, it's the history is there, but it's like narratively maximizing the history.
And some of it seems like synthetic, right? This layer on the side where the plaster goes up is like, this is the old stuff.
Yeah.
But I think it might just be old stuff he's just put there.
The old
stuff is the same age as everything else.
Equally, like the stair, the historic stair is actually pretty banal, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's made much more exciting.
Pretty banal and seemingly also kind of fine.
Yeah. Like, yeah, the whole of the city is probably all the stairs. The most of the stairs in the city probably look like this. But
yeah, so it's really just using it as a
as a decoration
for his new thing.
Yeah, there's a we found this film of him which we're probably going to play bits of during the discussion, but what one of the things that he says is, you know, like, it doesn't even really matter if
it doesn't have to be any good. If the object doesn't have to be any good, I can make it great. Just by framing it right, which is completely true.
Yeah, it is true. You could kind of make it way more interesting than it really is. As with the thing we were talking about before, like the where it has this special cutaway for the little capital, like there must be a billion of those in the city. They're
not that much of a step up from something you could buy.
Yeah,
like you could definitely buy them online.
But you will always notice them and kind of go up to them and sort of notice the labor of cutting that little architrave because of the way it's treated, which is very effective.
But also, you're not just noticing that.
Yeah,
you're actually just noticing the whole assemblage.
Yeah.
That is the level at which his designs are complete. They're complete at the level of the bit of the room.
Yeah.
Or the sub grand element.
Yeah.
Like the intervention element. And I would say the small things are designed as parts of things at that level. And the big thing is designed as an assemblage of things at that level, really.
Yeah. And then there is... The garden is also that he has a kind of landscape scheme for. I don't know how much to say about it, but there are like yet more of these little sculptural set pieces and
hovering slabs. We'll always see those. So this is like when you have something. He loves a shadow gap underneath it, so it feels like it's floating. This is
also like things inset in other things.
Yeah,
like there's nothing which can't be improved by having a little frame around it. And then some of his most kind of curiously like. Precious and like again kind of future sci-fi sort of shag pad sort of feeling are these various like
they might be slightly underselling them, they
these kind of labyrinthine little miniature water features.
Yeah,
they do feel they're real, like Galactic Empire kind of set dressing.
I think that's kind of slightly what you read. I mean, they don't feel quite that. But, you know, I get what you're seeing. And something else that... Carlo or Scarpa, I don't know what the style, style
the professor, is. The professor. The professor is what the everyone
professor,
refers to.
The professor started off, before he was doing architectural works, was doing mainly sculptural works.
Yeah.
As in designing sculptural works to be manufactured for... tombs and little public interventions.
Yeah.
I guess that's what was doing in the 40s as well. But in a way, he comes out of what's the first stuff he designs? Vases.
Yeah.
And then he's doing sculptures. And so it's not strange to see little sculptural inserts all over his projects. Architects are often very fearful of this. It doesn't feel quite like our job. But he wasn't an architect. He never qualified.
Yeah.
And he designed a lot by sort of like looking at the place and having things to put in it and
Yeah.
A lot of his projects don't have complete sets of drawings.
Yeah, like
there'll
a lot...
tons of drawings, but not like... There's no tender package.
No. There's a... I mean, I think he's definitely part of the, like, secret conspiracy of interior designers who are... who everyone thinks of as, like, heroes of architecture.
Yeah. That's the moment. Yeah, he relates to the human scale.
Yeah.
He doesn't... He said, I just want a pharaoh so I can build a pyramid. But actually, he can't do pyramids. Even even him at his most imperial pomp, it's still things that are, like, 2-3 times human dimensions.
Yeah. I just wanted to say one thing about... I've basically left out all the kind of upper floor stuff because I don't think that we'd need to talk about it particularly. There are one or two little interventions. And as you said, most of the stuff in the house is not super interesting, but there is one particular very famous painting by Bellini, which is the presentation at the temple, which is a very beautiful, very sort of solemn picture of the Virgin handing over Jesus to... whoever that is. Who's the old priest? Yeah,
I don't know which one.
Yeah, everyone is very, very, like, very sad, very it's, beautiful.
I mean, did we go to that exhibition together?
I'm not sure. I think we might have gone to it separately. Yeah. So this was on display in London a few years ago, as part of the Bellini Mantegna show, but the way that he displays it, which is something he loves doing, is to make this sort of bespoke, very thin easel that holds it and which sort of emphasizes its fragility, and it's kind of it stops it being part of the wall, which paintings normally feel like part of the wall.
Yeah, and when they feel like part of the wall, they are often wall decorations.
Yeah.
And they become, if they are really special paintings, they become really special when you look at the painting.
Yeah.
Whereas this is obviously special when you walk into the room, even if you can't see the painting, because it's hanging in space on an easel.
Yeah.
Taking up a whole chunk. You know, it demands, it won't stand for a corner.
Yeah.
It demands this central position. Which, I mean, this is definitely the best work of art they've got.
Yeah. It's a major work of art. It's a major, yeah. This is one you'll have seen if you've done a, you know, art history course or something like that.
I've no idea. I really don't know what our history courses are like.
Yeah, we kind of imagine we would have anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we mentioned before, Scarpa is someone that architecture students are often told to look at as a kind of reference point for what a design process is meant to look like, which is...
But almost never does. Like, it's just really how it...
Yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of relevant the way that he worked as well, which is that he had like a very small studio. And I think often basically worked alone. He did lots of projects during his life, but he didn't have a huge amount on at the same time. And he liked to kind of really work into and develop these elements one at a time, often seemingly like existing in their own little world. And his tools for doing that are generally orthography more than anything else.
Orthography combined with sketch. Yeah. Like perspectival sketch.
Little sketches here. Yeah. Little sketches here and there.
But orthography means measured
plans and sections.
Measured drawings.
Yeah. Yeah.
Drawings without perspective as well.
Yeah. 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 The sort of development of the bridge element kind of shown off in one of these books.
Yeah, this one with circles feels really Central Europe.
Yeah, which got in here somewhere. There's a whole lot of other ones as well.
Yeah.
Also, the process often goes from the whole thing to the detail and back again, sometimes on top of each other on the same page. That one of them, you've sort of got the whole bridge at like 1 to 10 looks like, you know, where you can see like the layering and sort of biscuiting of the different wooden elements, but then you've also got like a big 1-to-1 handle drawn like in the middle of the whole thing, and you've got often even they're more chaotic than that, where you've got like just stuff everywhere.
And not only that, you also had another version of it on the of the handrail at a different scale on the drawing itself.
Yeah.
This bridge is superimposed. He's also doing the thing of like work out the massing of it, and yeah, then going through layers of detailing until he's got to really fine detailing.
Yeah.
And this little bridge, which is only 4 meters, 5 meters wide.
Yeah. Long. Yeah.
Long.
And,
yeah. And
it's like wide enough to hold both handrails at the same time. Yeah.
1.4 meters wide.
Yeah.
Really designed out, and very, very, like everything, hyper-articulated.
Yeah.
The sort of journey of the line of a post supporting the balustrade kind of goes, well, there's a thing connecting to the frame, and that connects to a connection, which connects to a rod, which goes up, which has got another kind of thing around it, which goes up into something which then has a bit of metal that connects to it, which is clamped into another bit of metal, which is clamped into
which has a wiggle,
which then has a line going off it, which then supports two balustrades. Each of which then have further elaborations.
That's the way he likes to do it. It's
it's kind of anti value engineering.
Yes. Yeah. I don't think he had to deal with that problem. I think also there's a nice bit in the documentary that was done with him where they talked to all of his workmen, the artisans that he would work with. So they talked to like the metalworking company and the woodworking company. And I think that part of the reason he has this design process is that he had a certain relationship with the fabricators, which was that he could take a drawing in more or less any state and go and talk to them about it and sometimes leave it there.
Yeah. So, this would be, it would be punishingly hard to assemble all the people you needed to make these projects from scratch.
Yeah.
Like one element would feel achievable, but there's so many. Like, you require quite a few specialist firms.
Yeah.
Who have to be really invested.
Yeah.
And on board with the idea of making this artwork.
Yes. They want to,
I reckon people would, but you'd need enough demand to support all these people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's very dependent on a certain sort of ecosystem of craft.
Gorgeous stuff.
But it is also, I guess what I wanted to stress is I think that without like a huge amount of mutual trust also.
Yes.
I don't think that you would be able to work in the way that he worked.
It's not completely un-Ruskinian.
Yeah.
Although it's not the workman, it's the firm.
Yeah.
It's the supervisor.
Yeah. I wonder if we might... Shall we do an ending in case we want to end it?
Sure.
Because also my computer's doing something strange.
Yeah.
And it would allow us to have a quick break.
Well, that's the Querini Foundation. There's not a lot more to it.
No.
It's very... I think it's a really... I haven't been there.
Yeah.
Well, do you want to have, just before we finish, like, you have been there.
Yeah, so I've been there a couple of times. I went there, I guess, in 2008, 2007 as an undergraduate. And then I went back this last year when I was in Venice. And what is it like? It is amazing. It's architecture of a kind of degree of precision and kind of variety that feels like it would be purely on like a technical level very difficult to design all of. Like, it requires relentless productivity, like to be very, very creative, to be sort of relentless in the activity of designing. And then also it requires a kind of relationship with a client and with the people who are building it that it feels like, I just feels like it's completely outside of the bounds of possibility. It's so totally.
This is a guy who was designing, I think, like 4 vases a week, week in, week out.
Yeah.
It's that mentality of,
yeah,
I'm going to do all of these, the like list of drawings you'd have to do, you know, if you were going to draw it all out, would just be terrifying.
Yeah. And yes, in a way, with all of his projects, there is a slight thing where the quality of the architecture is such that it does slightly like smother everything else that the building is meant to be about.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I mean by like it's intrusive.
But I don't really mind it being a kind of Carlo Scarpa theme park because there aren't very many of them.
Yeah,
and it is a wonderful and extraordinary thing.
Of course, it's a gorgeous thing to have. Yeah, like, but you know,
much better than like a slightly second-rate, you know, Noble House Museum, which you know,
which are real banality.
Venice has lots and lots of them.
But I mean, even
if it didn't have that painting, it would definitely
it would have no. Yeah. There would be nothing there.
No really top stuff. I think there's a library which scholars are fond of for one reason or another. But
probably because it's in that building.
Yeah, I guess it has.
I mean, yeah. Like, what do scholars use library for? They use them as a classier version of a cafe.
Yeah,
80% and 20%
specific resources, them, haven't they?
But I wouldn't neglect the
Vibes are a big part. Yeah, I think it's got lovely vibes, I think people do like to go and work there. It's like 100%. It's an essential visit if you're into architecture and you've never been to a Carlo Scarpa building. It's absolutely a thing to always do if you get the chance because they're so unlike anything else.
That's true of basically everything.
I mean,
every Carlo Scarpa building.
Oh yeah, all of them. That's what I mean. Yeah, all of them are.
Of course, it's not true of everything. Yeah. I mean, every Carlo Scarpa building.
Yeah. No, there's all...
like if there's a Carlo Scarpa thing,
it's worth it.
It's always going to be worth it, because they're all cool.
Yeah. So we're just going to wrap that one up there. We're trying to do sort of slightly shorter episodes at the moment to give people.
Yeah, we're going to try and we're going to try and get back into the swing of things again.
Various things.
Never apologize, never explain.
But
let's just carry on.
But that's the way it is. Remember that if you want to support the show, if you like what we do, we have a Patreon where you can pay for various incidental expenses and generally
and Matt
enable like our editor Matthew Lloyd Roberts.
I wouldn't describe it as an incidental expense. That feels a bit
if you want like additional content we've
on there. There's more.
Yeah, there's more. We're on various platforms. Our handle is generally at about underscore buildings. The Patreon and everything else, there are links on our website, aboutbuildingsandcities.org, or if you're watching this on YouTube, on our page in the bio. That's all the stuff we normally say, isn't it?
That's it. If you're feeling nice, you can review it. You review us. Thanks for listening and potentially watching.
Yes. Like and subscribe, as they say.
If you must.
Bye.
Bye-bye.